Spend your life stuck in a car until you feel like dying. No, sir, the landscape is paved. There's no sidewalks anywhere because it's a shithole. Yes, sir. Oh, fuck. You know, there's a reason. There's a reason I punished myself with the oldies station when I was younger. What was the Chicago oldies station? Remember, like, before, it was like, this is like 90s. This is like childhood for me. I remember just hearing the oldies station. It was one of the only tolerable radio stations. You know, if someone didn't have like a CD player in their car or even like a tape player in their car. Anyway, I'm just fucking ranting again about the Texas car landscape, which is really what so much of the United States looks like. It is just so fucking brutal. You know, I did not intend to live around this stuff. I moved to West Texas, where the nearest Walmart's like an hour away. There's none of that shit. You could park your car and walk around, you know, in this little small town I moved to. But right now, I'm at the southern end of the I-35 corridor, which is just a continuous car and retail slum. You know, do you get tired of hearing this shit from me? Does it ever get fucking old? Maybe not. Maybe you're filled with hate towards it, too. Maybe you got this sneaking suspicion something's wrong and the human beings weren't supposed to live this way. We didn't evolve for this kind of bleak shit of just being farmed as consumers and stuck in these fucking, you know, 4,000 pound moving metal boxes all day. But I really don't get tired of ranting about it. I could do a whole fucking, you know, hour or two bedtime story about how much I hate this shit and how it's going to be looked on in a few hundred years if we make it that far and don't annihilate ourselves as a civilization. How it's going to be looked on is what a fucking unfortunate and just goofy ass way to live. And the only reason we do it in the United States is because we have so much fucking space. I mean, this shit is everywhere, don't get me wrong, but it's not to this degree. You go to Australia, they have this dumb shit there. You go to places in Europe, they have this dumb shit there, but certainly not as much. You know, just the strip mall stuff, the driving everywhere. Actually, Europe doesn't, I've never been there, but from what I hear, it's not as big over there because they just don't have the space. And everyone drives those tiny cars anyway. But, you know, fuck, South America, places I've been, I don't see this shit. It's just a really miserable fucking way to live. So, anyway, okay, we'll wrap that up. I just a good opener, you know, just shitting on American car culture, strip mall culture, and the futureless retail slum. I could open every podcast with that if I could. That said, I got a really interesting conversation for you today with Dr. Corey Nelson. We're talking about BioCrusts. Now, some of you might wonder, that doesn't sound interesting. BioCrusts are not that cool. And I would say, yes, they are, dummy. You don't sound like you're viewing the whole picture. You don't sound like you got your head on straight, like you're thinking about things, you know, in the correct way. All right, with a zoomed out perspective. Anyone who spent any time doing desert botany knows how fucking cool some of these living films are. Okay, when you're out there, especially looking at cacti, and you see some of these cactus seedlings, you're going to be looking at BioCrust too. When you look beneath your feet and realize the entire ground is alive, whether it's like a juniper woodland, high elevation juniper woodland in New Mexico, you know, just juniper trees with openings in the woodland, or whether it's chaparral landscape, or whether it's gypsum deserts. Holy hell, on the fucking gypsum, there's some cool stuff. You will realize how fucking fascinating the subject is. And so I finally found a kind gentleman who was willing to talk to me about it. And so we get into it. We talk about cyanobacteria. We talk about lichens. We talk about nitrogen fixation. We talk about heterotrophs versus autotrophs, both doing nitrogen fixation. We talk about that black, the reason so many BioCrusts are black. This was a really cool conversation. And we just talk about how great it feels to just be out in the field and looking at this wonderful fucking just kaleidoscopic patchwork of life all around you. I had that moment a few days ago in the Peyote Gardens down here in South Texas, at a spot that's unfortunately getting cleared for a fucking border wall. I'll do a whole other separate podcast on that. I also saw Salvia white housei, which is a really cool fucking salvia. I believe it's Texas endemic. It might be in northern Mexico too. I did not realize when I went out there to go look at it, because I've got a plant growing in my garden from seeds someone sent me, whoever that was, thank you, by the way, 2 or 3 years ago, back when I lived in Oakland. I finally germinated the seed. I got a plant growing in my garden. But I did not realize that when I went out to see this thing at dusk on a wonderful, cool Chihuahua desert evening, it was fucking chilly, man. You know, on these undulating limestone hills, I did not realize that salvia species was moth pollinated. It's fucking moth pollinated salvia. What the fuck? Scott Zona says there's another species of salvia that's moth pollinated, Salvia arborescens, in the Dominican Republic. I need him to send me money shots of that. He didn't actually follow through on it, by the way, but I'll have to harass him again. But that's okay, because I like harassing Scott Zona. Not really harassing. I'm being, you know, for any fucking literalists out there who can't detect the joking nature of my tone, not colloquial. What the fuck am I talking about? You know, Scott Zona is a fucking wizard of botany. So follow him on his Instagram page or his fucking Twitter, whatever. It's like following a botany textbook. And the dude actually just came out with a great book, which we talk about in my podcast with him, our podcast episode, like 5 episodes back, 6. I don't know. Who the fuck knows? You can find that on the catalog if you go backward a little bit. It's a crash course. Scott Zona's botany crash course. So anyway, this salvia, I was out there and I did notice the long tube flowers. Got a long tube. I did notice the generally light color. It's like a light pink color. It's like a pink trying to be white. You know, because it's easier to spot at night. And I there was no scent yet, but it, you know, a lot of these flowers don't end up emitting scent. A lot of moth pollinated flowers don't end up emitting scent until dusk anyway, whether they're orchids or fucking members of Nyctaginaceae at 4 o'clock, whatever. And then I saw a sphinx moth on one and kind of zoomed by my head, sounding like a little hummingbird. It was fucking wild. And then I just had that moment where I'm like, holy shit, these are pollinated by moths. It's a moth pollinated salvia, which I didn't think existed. I could have guessed it probably did, but I don't know. It was so cool. It was such a beautiful night too. I mean, just so much. There was Thymophila acerosa out there, that little spiny Thymophila. With Thymophila, of course, is one of the little desert marigolds, Tagetae, Tagetae, the marigold tribe of Asteraceae. It was a really wonderful experience, like it always is, being in the Chihuahua desert and away from the car slum, which I will never hesitate to shit on repeatedly. It's getting time to leave the country. If I'm still in the United States in a decade, I don't know, man. It's not a good scene here, you know? Listen to me. Run. Is that all you could do? You just run away? Huh? You're goddamn right, man. I don't want to live around a fucking culture like this that just embraces shopping and driving so much. So that was an experience. But anyway, being in the peyote gardens, saving plants from the 200-foot-wide swath that they're cutting for the border wall, and of course, looking at all the peyotes were blooming too. Man, there were these really cool Acmeodera beetles in there. Their larvae bore into wood, I guess. They bore into the prosopis. And they bore into the blackbrush too, of course, and as well as Karwinskia humboldtiana, a.k.a. Coyoteo, which is a pretty far-reaching member of the Rhamnaceae, the buckthorn family. So I've seen it in Puebla and Oaxaca State, down in Mexico as well, except it's very small leaved down there. And when you look at the venation, it looks like a frangula. Like, it looks like some of the more temperate zone members of Rhamnaceae that we're familiar with, you know, temperate zone North American natives, not European buckthorn, obviously, but it's just these, the larva bore into dead wood. So it's another good reason to, you know, if you live in a region, to stack up dead logs in your yard. I got a bunch of dead logs I was going to use for firewood, like a bunch of mesquite. I went out and chainsawed down, off a branch that had fallen, cracked off a tree. And I was going to use it for firewood, but then I'd go outside in my garden and I'd hear these little clicking noises, which was not this beetle, but it was, you know, another wood-boring beetle, and like little scraping noises. And then I saw all these holes in the sawdust, and it was, you know, insects boring into this wood. And so now I feel bad burning it because I think the fucking larval, I think the larval stage for some of these guys is like a year. So anyway, but it was cool. I've been talking to all these entomologists trying to figure out more about this. It's amazing how this stuff works. You know, you get into one thing and then it just more questions open up, more answers open up more questions, and then you just want to learn. Suddenly you're asking about, you know, entomology and insects, wood-boring beetles, and soil crust. So anyway, I'll just cut to the chase and we'll get into this conversation right now. So enjoy it. And I still got a couple, I think I got like 20 or 30 stickers, envelopes to send out. So you can always email me if you didn't get yours yet. And I'll get on it. But I've just been so fucking busy, man. I don't have enough time. And I've like stopped responding to messages and emails entirely. Like even like text messages, I just don't respond anymore. So anyway, that aside, yeah, keep, I don't know, keep doing your thing. And hopefully you get something out of this conversation. I know I did. And yeah, I don't know. I guess I'm going to be going to Florida first week or two of April too, and making some videos in North Florida with my friend Lilium. So it should be good. Should be a lot of good stuff there. She's got a job with Florida Native Plant Society, so she knows her shit very well. And I don't know. We'll be getting into the landscape there. Anyway, that's all I got. Have a good rest of your afternoon. Go fuck yourself. Bye.
You know, on the outside they're soft, and they seem like they got nice, soft, liberal variants, but then they just start tagging each other, and claws come out. You know, I've seen a couple knifings in that room before. Get a bunch of hippies clubbing each other with the cucumbers, throwing shit, fighting to get, you know, the cheapest avocados. Like $1.39 for 8 of these. They're about to go bad, but they're not bad yet.
Okay, welcome to the Crime Pays podcast. Today, I got, are you Dr. Corey Nelson? Officially?
Yeah, I've recently minted.
Okay, hello, doctor. We got Dr. Corey Nelson, and we are talking about biocrust, and some people, I mean, anyone who listens to fucking Crime Pays has heard me rant about how cool I think they are before. I don't think it's a mystery why we would cover them, but anyway, we're just going to launch right into it, and we'll start asking questions. So, Dr. Nelson, would you like to explain what you do, who you are, your background, give us a little bit of insight, et cetera?
Yeah, sure. I'm an American. I'm actually in Spain now studying biocrusts and climate change, but I actually went to grad school at Arizona State University where I studied the microbial ecology of biological soil crusts. Specifically, I studied the symbiotic relationship between the pioneer cyanobacteria, so the photosynthetic bacteria found in crusts, and heterotrophic nitrogen-fixing bacteria, and how they trade resources to allow biocrusts to form. So from there, I just have been following my interest in microbial ecology, the interaction of bacteria and other microbes in their own micro-ecosystems, and seeing where that takes me.
Okay, so you said cyanobacteria, which a lot of them fix nitrogen, right? And then you said heterotrophic bacteria, meaning ones that don't photosynthesize. Cyanobacteria, of course, photosynthesize. Heterotrophic, you know, as opposed to autotrophic, heterotrophic, you know, consume other things. So there's heterotrophic bacteria that fix nitrogen too?
Correct, yeah. So generally, these will be found in oligotrophic environments, so environments that don't have a lot of nutrients available. So they're able to scavenge any carbon sources they need to actually power their cellular machinery to pull in atmospheric nitrogen and fix it into something they can use, which is used for proteins and all of the things that make cells work.
Right. Okay. So we're gonna get into nitrogen fixation, brother. But first, I want to say the reason I got into these is because I spend a lot of time doing botany in deserts, and I spend a lot of time, you know, studying small cacti, everything from peyote to, you know, species like Aztecium ritteri, which grows in Mexico on these basically vertical walls composed of thousands of years of, you know, alluvial deposits piling up at the mouths of canyons. I mean, Aztecium can also grow on flat surfaces, but very rarely. Geohintonia is another cactus species Geoantonio mexicana that grows on vertical rock walls composed entirely of gypsum. Some of the most bizarre fucking plant habitat I've ever seen in my life. And looking at these plants, I couldn't help but notice the crust that was everywhere. I mean, it's like just staring you right in the face. I mean, large plants like Selaginella, you know, the resurrection plant. Down there, it's Gypsicola. In West Texas, we get Selaginella lepidophila. But there would be crusts everywhere. There'd be, the whole wall is alive. It's not just the gypsum. And I would just look at them, you know, it's this black crust, but you could tell there's something there. It's not just dirt. And then you realize it's this whole network of all these intertwined organisms. It was just so fucking fascinating. These crusts, of course, have a huge role to play in the germination of many of these seedlings. Seeds will catch, you know, the crust, you know, when they're moist, of course, when they're not dormant, become wet. They catch the seedlings, or they catch the seeds germinate. They provide like a nice spongy substrate for these seeds to germinate on. It was just fascinating. So I figured, and then I realized I don't know much about them, and they just blew my fucking mind. So here we are. So first I want to ask, why arid environments? Why are these things so prevalent in arid environments? Let's talk about that.
So biocrusts actually can form anywhere where the light touches the soil, but most often that's in drylands because precipitation limits vegetation. So right. That's where you'll most often find wide open patches of bare soil.
Right.
Okay. So that's really the big reason why a majority of biocrusts are found in drylands.
So they got it. They have a competitive edge basically because there's no plants to get in the way. There's less plants to get in the way.
Yes, and in addition to that, a lot of the biocrust organisms themselves are desiccation tolerant, so they can be rehydrated and dry out without much damage. So that's also another advantage that they have.
So is that poikilohydric? Would that be the word you would use to describe that potentially, or what is that?
Yes, exactly. That's a very specific and exact word for that.
Poikilohydric.
So yeah, they actually use compatible solutes like sugars and things to crystallize themselves.
Yeah, so how...
That's kind of the...
Sorry to interrupt you. How do they do that? I mean, how does something, because I've seen lichens, I've seen these fucking things growing. That's the other thing that's so fascinating about them is I'll see them growing in places where nothing should be growing. Like on the surface of a granite rock, well, at least in the case of lichens, or at the base of a granite rock in the Mojave Desert where it's 115 degrees for 4 to 5 months out of the year. With no rain. I mean, how do they do this? What's their gimmick?
So there's a lot of different mechanisms for doing this. The one I know most about is the one that cyanobacteria use. Because they're photosynthetic, they're able to fix carbon, and they're able to fix it into sugars, which they can then saturate their cellular environment. And when they dry out, it actually crystallizes and maintains the structure of the cell while it's dry, and it can be dry like that for years and decades before getting wet again and starting off like nothing happened.
Yeah, that's not so. It's really just about keeping the structural integrity of the cell together during dormancy. I mean, is that the main thing? Because what happens when things dry out? They just wrinkle, they shrivel, all those, the structure falls apart, or what?
Yeah. So when they when all of the water leaves the cell, you get breaks in the membrane. So then when it's rehydrated, you lose the integrity of the cell and it causes cell death. But right. If you can crystallize your structure before then, you have a lot less damage to your membrane.
Yeah. It sounds like something similar to maybe what some plants can do during a freeze if they're not going dormant, you know, if they're not just storing all their sugars down in the roots and closing up their buds. But anyway, okay. So let's talk about, so why are they black so much of the time? Like you'll be in deserts, you'll see these crusts. You know, I've been in gypsum deserts in Washington County, Utah. There's a cool little plant called Arctomycon humulus, the bear poppy, the dwarf bear poppy. It grows on this just colorful mosaic of all these intertwined lichen species. I mean, it's like looking at the ground is beautiful. Like it's mesmerizing almost. And again, growing on these gypsum areas, but it's, you know, the big color there is black. Is that just when they're dry basically or what?
So actually, that is, a product of a very specific kind of cyanobacteria. So these are the nitrogen-fixing cyanobacteria, most commonly nostoc, cytonema, or Tollypothrix. And this black pigment is actually called cytonimin.
Oh, my God.
So they produce this cytonimin and coat their cells with this pigment so that when they dry out, because these cyanobacteria cannot are not motile, so they can't retreat from the sun when they start to dry out.
Right.
They actually create a sunscreen that they place on themselves so that when they dry out, the sun, the UV rays, don't damage their genetic material while they're dormant.
God, that's so it's actually cool.
Yeah.
How do you spell cytonimin?
Let's see.
Just so someone can... Oh, okay, S.
S-C-Y-T... Cytonimin. Cytonimin. And it comes from... it was discovered in cytonema, which is one of those...
Nitrogen-fixing. Okay, yeah, I see it. So if anyone wants to look it up at home, it's S-C-Y-T-O-N-E-M-I-N. They got, it looks like they got a Wikipedia page for it. So, so this is like melanin pigment kind of for cyanobacteria, kind of.
Exactly.
Okay. So that's why you get that. But then when they're actively metabolizing and photosynthesizing and fixing nitrogen, do they turn a different color or what happens?
So you'll see more of a green through the black, but the cytonimin production is actually induced by exposure to UV light. So as long as they are exposed to the UV light, they're actually being induced to create cytonimin and exude it.
So. Okay. And then basically how long, so say it's, you know, it's been dry for 5 months and scorching hot and they're in this dormant state. How long does it take upon, you know, getting a really heavy fog? Because fog can do this too, right? You don't necessarily need rain. Or just a good rain. How long does it take for them to basically light up and become active and start doing their thing?
So actually, there's been some studies to measure this, and they found oxygen generation slightly before 30 minutes after rehydration. So it does not need to be a long time or a lot of precipitation for them to become active again.
Jesus. Okay. And so, I mean, that's pretty quick. I remember there's a really cool plant called Welwitschia mirabilis that is just, it's out on its own weird, you know, evolutionary branch of the it's a gymnosperm. It's more closely related to redwoods than it is to flowering plants, but it grows in Namibia in these fog deserts. And it's weird. The closer you get to the coast, the more barren it gets because you've got these cold ocean currents, you know, off the western coast of Africa. And I remember being there and the it wasn't really a crust. It was more like actual just lichen growing on the ground. It was fucking nuts. But yeah, I mean, these things would just, you know, there's no rain out there. It's all fog. Like all the precipitation comes from fog and it gets super foggy at night and it stays till the morning. And then, you know, the sun comes out a few hours later, just like typical Bay Area weather, like Bay Area summer, you know, like coastal California summer. And then by noon, it's sunny and blazing hot. So, you know, and what all the few plants that grow out there, well, Welwitschia and this other species in the amaranth family that's kind of a shrub or is a shrub, and then just lichens everywhere have adapted to this. So fog is really important for this stuff. I mean, and that, of course, I guess works with the whole, you know, being able to just, you know, open a kitchen and start cooking within, you know, 30 minutes of moisture. So how much does temperature affect these things too? I mean, do they just need moisture or they need cooler temperatures or what?
That also really depends. There's actually a niche differentiation between the different cyanobacteria that can make up biocrusts. So for example, the most common biocrust cyanobacteria, Microcholis vaginatus, prefers cooler temperatures. So you'll find them dominating crusts at higher latitudes or altitudes. And on the other end, a polyphyletic clade of cyanobacteria called Coleofasciculaceae actually prefer it to be much more hot and humid. So you'll find them at lower latitudes or lower altitudes where it gets hotter. So it actually changes which cyanobacteria are a part of the community depending on the climate of the local area.
Wow. I figure there's probably a lot of variation there. So you said it's a polyphyletic clade. Was this was all thought to be one organism at one point or something, and then it was determined it was a couple different organisms or what?
Yes, exactly. So it all used to be lumped together in an organism called Microcholius steenstrupii, which is the counterpart to Microcholius vaginatus. But it was actually found that within this group of steenstrupii are different clades that prefer very specific different climactic niches. And they're actually not very closely related. Microcholius vaginatus and steenstrupii. So it's kind of interesting because they both play the same role in the ecosystem, but they're not phylogenetically close, even though they look the same and perform the same function.
Okay, well, along those lines, there's a couple things I want to ask you too. Is, you know, are many of these, you know, like with a lot of fungi, it was assumed that similar lookalikes you'd get in Europe were assumed to be the same species to somewhat similar lookalikes you'd see in North America, and then it was determined, no, that the Atlantic Ocean is actually a pretty good barrier to genetic swapping, and these were actually two different species of fungi, you know. So instead of, you know, that's, I guess that's what I'm getting, is are a lot of these different species of soil crusts, are they generalists? Are they found all over the world, or are they, can some of them, most of them are pretty niche, like they'll be stuck in one area, and they've basically been isolated there for a long time. Basically, how in terms of distribution and biogeography, you know, how do these things get around? Do they get around, or are they pretty isolated, or, you know, as a generality?
They can get around. So that's another very interesting thing. So like I said before, Microcholius vaginatus, which is the most common biocrust cyanobacteria, is actually global. You can find it on every single continent, and it's actually a monophyletic group. So Microcholius vaginatus has one species that's everywhere on the planet.
And how do you spell that?
But on the other side, the Colloidea fasciculaceae can only be found in certain places and isn't found everywhere.
What's the vaginata one you said, Mike? Because I saw this name last night in a paper. What is it? Micro? How do you spell that? In case people want to look it up.
Microcholius. So
Microcholius.
Microcholius, like little thread in Greek, and then vaginatus. VAGINATUS.
Oh, there we go. Okay, nice Science Direct page on it. Holy shit, that's cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so these and these are endosymbiotic. Oh, okay, this is just talking about cyanobacteria in organic soils. Okay, so this one is pretty common. This is the one that's found in arid environments all over the world.
Yes.
Okay, and so a lot of these crusts, because we're not just talking about cyanobacteria, right? When we're talking about soil crusts, we're talking about fungi, we're talking about yeast. What else? With mosses in some cases. What would you, to get a good circumscription of the whole community, how many different organisms are involved here when we're talking soil crusts, and whether it's Utah or Namibia or wherever?
So it can include a ton of different organisms. And really, biocrusts are generally described as where they are in their ecological succession. So, for example, an early successional biocrust would be mostly composed of cyanobacteria like Microcholius vaginatus. Those are the ones that actually come in and stabilize the soil so that when non-modal organisms come, next, like the nitrogen-fixing cyanobacteria, Nostoc, Cytonema, Tolypothrix, they can come sit on the top. They're the ones that create the cytonamin, that create that black crust. Depending on your soil or how much precipitation the area gets, you can then get other organisms such as mosses or lichens to come and colonize and grow there. And all of those photosynthetic microorganisms, or in the case of lichens and mosses, bryophytes, they support a big community of heterotrophic organisms like fungi, archaea, bacteria, protozoa, even small arthropods and things like that. So
damn. Okay, so so it gets
what lives there is based off of the who the photosynthetic component of the crust is.
So this gets way more complicated as time goes on and as the crust develops. But cyanobacteria are the ones that kind of, you know, pioneer a barren landscape and get established first.
Yes.
Wow, and it's not even the nitrogen fixtures that show up first. It's just regular cyanobacteria that can go dormant and live, you know, just live yeah. live that harsh lifestyle and get everything prepped for what comes next. And so, how are these things getting around? Is it just spores, or how do they transport?
They transport around through flows, hydrological distribution, so overland flow of water. In dry lands, anybody who lives in dry lands know that it can be very dusty. So the dust particles can contain or have the trichomes of these cyanobacteria pioneers attached. They can be brought long, long distances and deposited where then they can grow and stabilize the soil in a faraway location. They've actually found cyanobacteria from the Sahara in Africa come across the Atlantic, and they could find cyanobacteria in that dust that blows off of the Sahara in the dust that they were finding in the United States. So it can easily make it across the ocean given the right conditions.
Right, yeah, right. The living dust. That's cool. You said the trichomes of the cyanobacteria, like little hairs or what?
Yeah, so actually, the pioneer cyanobacteria are filamentous, meaning they just have a lot of individual cells that make a filament or a hair. And a bunch of hairs come together inside of a bundle. So you'll find hundreds of these little multicellular hairs surrounded by an exopolysaccharide sheath to make like a bundle or a rope. That actually is what stabilizes the soil. So it sticks to the soil particles and weighs them down. And that's where you get stabilization of the soil.
God damn it. Okay, because that's what I wanted to ask you next is how do these things form a crust? Like how when you because you can actually pick up crusts in some of these environments and see, I mean, what's holding it together? Let's talk about that. I mean, I know you just kind of touched on it, but let's really get into it. What are they doing? It's not fungal hyphae. I mean, sometimes it is, but mostly it's not when we're talking crust or especially cyanobacteria. What is that material made out of? How does it work?
So one of the reasons why the cyanobacteria I mentioned before are such good pioneers is their ability to make these bundles. So these bundles, the bulk of them are made of exopolysaccharides. So they're extracellular polysaccharides that are exuded and create a sticky organic glue around them.
So these are just long-chain sugars. They're like long-chain sugars or what?
Yes, exactly. So they think that the production of these exopolysaccharides has to do with their movement, which is gliding. So they actually excrete slime or this EPS to push themselves along, and they leave behind a slime trail. And when you take into account that they're also modal and low light adapted, they can react to intensity of the sun to move up and down the soil profile, and that's what makes that layer of sticky hard crust.
Oh God, that's so fucking cool, man! I was picking nostoc 2 days ago off the ground because there's this—it's terrible. There's this area here in South Texas that they're clearing for a border wall. There's a ton of cool cacti there. There's tons of peyote. It's like a 200-foot wide swath by like a mile, maybe more. I mean, it's the whole length of the border, but this one particular section, one of my favorite places here in South Texas, just huge species diversity, tons of rare plants, incredibly beautiful. This, you know, the ranch owner lets people have birding tours there, whatever. But, you know, nostoc is extremely common in South Texas, in the peyote gardens down here, in the star cactus, another cool species down here. And you'll see it. I mean, you know, you go out in January when it's like 50 degrees. I mean, it can be like 90 degrees in January too. It depends what day, you know, how the weather's moving. But you go out on like a cool January day and it looks like someone just blew their nose who had like a really bad green cold, just like someone blew their nose all over the ground. And that's nostoc. So when I pick that stuff up, What is that exactly? That's a film. What's the correct way to refer to it? I mean, is this what you're talking about? These are these exopolysaccharide sheaths bundled together, or what?
Yeah. So that goo that you're touching is just exuded sugars. For a lot of cultures, especially in China, they'll actually eat that because, you know, it's just sugars, complex sugars, but it's non-toxic. It's just a sticky organic glue. So.
Yeah. It looks like, it does look like that. It looks like nori. It looks like some fancy seaweed. If I were to take some of that dried and put it in a garden, how would I keep it alive?
Just treat it how the environment would treat it. So a lot of these organisms are really good at growing on the edge of what's possible for life. So when you actually make it too easy for them, they don't do well.
Right.
So if you wanted to grow your own crust at home, you would just, you could water it every so often, allow it to dry out, and essentially however you would treat your succulent that you have at home.
Right.
It doesn't like too much water. You can let it dry out and it'll be fine.
Does it need sun or does it need to be under a shrub? Because a lot of these things grow out here under this plant called blackbrush acacia, which is not really an acacia. Acacia, of course, was polyphyletic too. Now it's in the genus Vicelli, but it grows under this leguminous, you know, shrub to small tree. Does it need that? Does it need to be in sun? Would full sun kill it, or probably not? Huh?
Full sun wouldn't kill it. You'd probably not be able to see it as well because the components that could move would move below the soil surface, so that when they were dry, it would look like just bare soil. But when you wet it again, they would move up and you would see the green.
Jesus.
You can plant around the base of a plant, and that's actually where you do find a lot of really dark, thick crust. As long as the plant doesn't drop a lot of litter, because once you block out the sun, the organisms there die.
Yeah.
So as long as it doesn't drop a lot of litter, you can actually plant it around and you'll get a lot of green there.
So
it won't actually move below the soil surface because it's not so bright.
So these things can actually move below the soil surface and hide, basically. You won't see them.
Depends. So like those nitrogen fixers, the ones that create that black cytonamin, they are unable to move. They're non-modal. So they'll stay on the top and they'll just secrete that cytonamin and be a black cover to the soil. But the pioneers like Microcalis vaginatus have gliding motility. So they'll actually move down the soil profile out of sight to where the sun can't damage them.
So this gliding motility is really integral to the survival of some of these things they can't produce the cytonamin then, the ones that have the gliding, most of them can't?
Correct. And that's actually something that's very interesting is for being a cosmopolitan cyanobacteria, they can't fix nitrogen, which is strange for a pioneer species. And they also don't have these mechanisms like producing sunscreens and things in an environment that would be very damaging with UV.
Mm-hmm.
So their motility allows them to escape the sun, and their symbiosis with those nitrogen-fixing heterotrophs actually gets around their ability not to be able to fix nitrogen themselves.
Wow. Okay. Fucking this shit is so cool. I'm sorry. This is just, we haven't even touched on it. We're still just talking about cyanobacteria. I remember one time I was in the Mojave Desert and I was on a landscape entirely composed of decomposed granite. Cause you know, so much area in the Mojave, especially around, you know, Joshua Tree area, all that was, you know, the remnants of one gigantic pluton that was underground for millions of years. One giant pluton of granite. And so as it weathers, whatever, you get a bunch of cool rocks, you get quartz veins. And I went to go pick up a piece of quartz. And it was maybe 2 or 3 inches, but it was buried in the soil. Just the top was sticking out. When I picked it up on the underside, there was a bunch of green stuff. And I thought, what the fuck is it doing, you know, underground? That's pretty weird. I mean, obviously it's photosynthesizing. It's got chlorophyll in there, but you know, what do you think that was? That was probably a cyanobacteria. It was like a powdered, looked like a powdery algae or something.
Yeah. So that's actually another type of microbial community. They're called hypolithic microbial communities. So they actually live under rocks. And you'll find them, especially with those more translucent rocks that can let the light penetrate through.
Yeah.
And those are really hot spots for activity because they have the light needed for photosynthesis, but they're protected from the heat and from drying out too quickly, which is really what limits growth in this environment. So, yeah.
Jesus Christ, man. That is so cool. That's, I mean, it was fucking quartz. It was obviously, there was light getting through there. That is just so fucking nuts. I mean, there's like I don't know. So again, this is a cyanobacteria, not an algae, living underneath a rock in a place where it gets 115 degrees with no rain for like 5 months out of the year.
Yeah. Yep. They'll find a way wherever they can. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, so how do these things, how do they reproduce? That's what I wanted to know. Are they just asexual? They just make copies of themselves? Or is there any kind of, I mean, what's the reproductive biology? That may seem like a dumb question since we're talking about bacteria, and I apologize, but you're working with a beginner here. So so bear with me. How do they reproduce?
So for a lot of these, I mean, I know most about cyanobacteria. So for a lot of these filamentous cyanobacteria, they'll actually grow those filaments, those really long chains of cells. And once they hit a certain length of filament, they have cells that they program to die that split the filament into smaller filaments.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just one cell turns into two. It's you grow a filament and then you split the filament. And then the filaments go their separate ways, grow long and split again. So you're actually reproducing multicellular filaments instead of just cells.
Damn. Okay. So the whole thing comes off basically. But still, because they're so tiny, they can get picked up on dust particles on extremely windy days. They can get transported by water, etc.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay. So, all right. So moving on from the first off, I guess cyanobacteria fix nitrogen. And then you've got these, cytonamine producing bacteria that fix nitrogen too, but many of them are not photosynthetic.
They're not modal.
They're not modal. Okay. But there's heterotrophic nitrogen fixing bacteria involved in this picture as well, right?
Yes, there is.
Okay. And
so, sorry.
No, go ahead. So let's talk about the heterotrophic ones.
Yeah. So these have recently, so a lot of studies of biocrust have, for obvious reasons, because they're so obvious, focused on the photosynthetic components of biocrust. And not a lot of thought was put towards, you know, like what do the heterotrophic components, what do the fungi, the heterotrophic bacteria, archaea, what do they do in the crust? And recently it was found that these heterotrophic nitrogen fixers are actually super important for a biocrust being able to form at all in the first place, because the pioneer cyanobacteria that forms that initial crust that everything else can come colonize needs a source of nitrogen to be able to proliferate. We actually found that the cyanobacteria has a lot of physiological mechanisms that allow it to attract nitrogen fixers from the surrounding soil to its bundles and create its own microbiome that's enriched in nitrogen fixing bacteria.
So this is a mutualism between the heterotrophic, the non-photosynthetic nitrogen fixers, and then the autotrophic, the photosynthesizing cyanobacteria.
Yes, it's a mutualism that is absolutely required for these pioneer species to proliferate. So they actually they leak their photosynthates much more than any other cyanobacteria that's been studied, and they think that this is a way to attract nitrogen fixing heterotrophic bacteria because it's a source of carbon in an otherwise carbon poor environment.
So this is like, that's like putting a fresh pie on a windowsill for a hobo that you need to come do work for you, kind of, right? Like we're, you know.
Exactly.
Like I need someone to clean out my barn. So if I put this fresh pie on the windowsill, maybe, you know, the hobo will smell it and come to my house, and then I can, you know, get them in a backyard and say, hey, you want to make 10 bucks, you know, work something kind of like that. It's like, you got to lure them in. That is fucking cool. That is, and so what does the, so the, okay. So the heterotroph is getting carbon in a carbon poor environment, the fucking desert, because there it's so barren. And then, the cyanobacteria, of course, is getting nitrogen, which it can't produce itself. And so, fuck, man, that's cool. So this is almost like what's going on with lichens. I mean, it is basically kind of what's going on with lichens.
Yeah, it's a mutualism that is dynamic as well. So some experiments have shown that when the cyanobacteria isn't nitrogen starved, they actually push away nitrogen-fixing bacteria. So it seems that they're actually able to control which functional traits exist in their cyanosphere. So if they need something, they change the composition of the sugars and compounds that they exude to attract different heterotrophic bacteria.
Jesus Christ, that's cool. So you said cyanosphere. So let's talk, what is a cyanosphere exactly?
So a cyanosphere is analogous to the rhizosphere. It's the sphere of influence that the pioneer cyanobacteria has around itself. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to think, if you think of the rhizosphere, the area around roots that the plant has influence on, it's the same for the cyanobacteria.
Okay, got it. All right, so this is a really cool mutualism, but there's also cyanobacteria that associate with plants, obviously, especially like cycads, that produce, they do fix their own nitrogen. So how do they do that? And, you know, how do they differ, you know, structure? Like, why can't these pioneer cyanobacteria produce their own nitrogen?
That's a question that people are trying to figure out. Why they evolved, or how they evolved this other mechanism for getting nitrogen, and why wouldn't it have just been more, I guess, simple to have gotten the genes for nitrogen fixation through, you know, horizontal gene transfer or something in their distant past? Why this method of getting the nutrients they need is what evolved. And there's some evidence to suggest that it's because of the environment they live in, because of their bundle formation. They actually create a very dense amount of biomass that allows them to have a greater reach in the soil that they wouldn't have if they were just individual filaments. So it's kind of what came first. Did they learn how to support this mutualism, which then allowed them to come to dry lands, or did they come to dry lands where they where then, as a consequence of their ability to have bundles, did spontaneously this symbiosis occur?
There's got to be a benefit to not having to do it yourself. You know, you just contract it out. You contract the nitrogen fixation out. You don't have to worry about it. You can just focus on getting around and you know, making more yourself and you know, using the sun. So,
yeah.
That said, are there any of these bacteria that actually will help degrade rock that you know of, that can secrete enzymes somehow that can break down rock, or is that primarily just fungi that do that, or what?
I'm unsure if in desert crust there are cyanobacteria that do that, but in intercoastal marine areas where you have the, what is it called? It's not calcite. Like the calcium carbonate outcroppings and things like that, where the ocean touches the water, you actually find cyanobacteria in this niche area that are actually able to actively bore into rock. They have a mechanism that mines rock. So that they bore into it. And this is actually a adaptation to escape predation by snails and things like that. As they graze the surface, the cyanobacteria bore into the rock to get away from them.
Okay, yeah, because snail, that's snail food, right? I mean, you got like a you got a photosynthetic slime in the intertidal zone. That's old country buffet for snails, right?
Yes, exactly.
Damn. Okay. Well, that's still that's pretty cool, man. I know we're already like 40 minutes in, but I'm having a blast with this conversation, so I appreciate it. What's going on with nitrogen fixation? Let's explain to everybody why it's important. We got nitrogen in the atmosphere that we can't fucking use. It's got to be converted to an ammonium state, right? And so how is this done, and why are some bacteria so good at doing it? And what's the enzyme involved?
So, yes, like you said before, nitrogen is all around us, but it's very inaccessible, and it's because it's triple bonded, the nitrogen gas in the atmosphere, which is very, very stable and requires a very specific, very energy-intensive enzyme, nitrogenase, to actually fit in that dinitrogen gas and break it into two, where they can then add some hydrogens and make ammonium. So this is super important because this is what brings nitrogen back into the ecosystem through metabolic processes. A lot of nitrogen is denitrified from, you know, organic matter to ammonium to nitrate to nitrogen gas, which goes back into the atmosphere. And if there was no way to bring it back, eventually all the nitrogen would be gone and life couldn't go on. So nitrogen fixers are absolutely essential in every ecosystem, and a lot of how the ecosystem functions is very orbits really around what's happening to the organisms that can fix carbon, which is important, and fix nitrogen. So if you want to know how an ecosystem functions, you generally look at who's growing there, who can photosynthesize, and who's fixing the nitrogen.
Mm-hmm. And so is it only bacteria that can fix nitrogen?
Yes. Wow. So even plants that are known to enrich the soil in nitrogen, like legumes, they actually are in an association with nitrogen-fixing bacteria.
Right.
There's a lot of interest in trying to find a way to put nitrogen-fixing genes into plants so that they can produce essentially their own fertilizer. But it's a lot more complicated than it sounds, even though it's just one gene. The nitrogenase.
Right, yeah, we don't deserve that technology yet. We need to learn how to not fuck this planet into a coma before we can, you know, it's like...
I agree.
Yeah, so anyway, that's a privilege. That's an earned, technological advancement, or at least it should be. So bacteria are the only ones that can do this, and they use nitrogenase. Now, a lot of them, like if you look at like the roots of a legume, or you look at the coralloid roots of a cycad, they got these little nodules. The point of the nodule, right, is to give them a low oxygen environment. What's up with that? Why does nitrogenase need low oxygen?
So nitrogenase fits in the dinitrogen gas, but it also fits in oxygen, which actually irreversibly damages and kills the enzyme. So a lot of nitrogen fixers need to be in a low oxygen environment or have some other mechanism to remove oxygen from the area that they're trying to fix the nitrogen. Otherwise, they're killing their enzymes, and it's very costly to make and have to replace these enzymes. For the example with legumes, the low oxygen environment in those nodules, for example, in cyanobacteria, which fix nitrogen, which seems kind of counterintuitive, right? They're producing oxygen and also fixing nitrogen, they actually spatially separate where they're fixing their nitrogen and where they're fixing their carbon. So there's something called heterocysts in these nitrogen-fixing cyanobacteria in biocrusts that there is no photosynthetic machinery. It is only where they fix nitrogen.
Okay, so because that was going to be my other question, is some of these like heterotrophic bacteria, how do they do it? Where do they get it done? Heterotrophic bacteria that are fixing nitrogen that, you know, produce that cytonamin, how do they get it done? How do they create a low oxygen environment?
So depending on where they are, a lot of these processes can be either spatially divided or temporally divided. So for example, in biocrusts, I know I'm always going to bring it back to biocrusts, during the day they're hyperoxygenated, saturated in oxygen, but at night it flips to being almost anoxic because, of course, the cyanobacteria make oxygen during the day, but then they consume it at night when there's no light. So you'll actually find pulses of nitrogen fixation on day-night cycles, in environments like Biocrust. So there's a lot of tricks that can be done to find a low oxygen environment.
So they cook up oxygen during the day, and then they basically use it up when they're just respiring at night.
Yes.
Wow. Okay. That's pretty fucking cool. So again, these bacteria, these heterotrophic cytonamine producing nitrogen fixers, are they ever found by themselves, or are they always kind of bonded in this mutualism with the pioneer cyanobacteria?
So the nitrogen fixers that are generally found in that symbiosis are what are generally, I'm going into another topic here, what are generally designated as copiotrophic. So they would be bacteria that you would find in carbon-rich or very rich environments, as opposed to oligotrophic, which is, you know, very nutrient-poor environments. So these really good nitrogen fixers are actually associated with taxa that you would find in very rich soils. So it's a way of selecting for the bacteria that produce the nitrogen, but their mechanisms are not as conservative as an oligotroph who has to kind of ration their nitrogen. Mm-hmm. They're a little bit more sloppy. And that's why those specific types of nitrogen-fixing heterotrophs are associated with that symbiosis. And then those oligotrophs are very stingy, so they generally keep all of the nitrogen they make for themselves and don't are very much less likely to exude it or trade it.
Okay, and again, oligotrophy means, for anyone listening, in a nutrient-poor environment. Is that correct?
Or yes.
Adapted to a nutrient-poor? Okay, cool. So still talking about cyanobacteria, and I want to get... I'm sorry, man. This is going to be a long podcast, but I'm just so amped. And anytime you go off... Please, I invite you to do it. I love it. I just bring it, everything. I want to talk about everything here. So some cyanobacteria are toxic, right? Like some can be toxic to humans. Why is that?
So a lot of cyanobacteria can produce toxins. So probably the most common that people may have heard of is microcystis and microcystin, which is a neurotoxin for humans. Generally, those are associated with blooms in freshwater systems. As far as I know, there's been very little research done on whether or not or which cyanobacteria or algae or any organisms produce these toxins in soils or biocrusts. It's generally not something that's come up, and I think it's because populations don't get as dense in the soils because they're really constrained to that top half a centimeter that gets the sunlight as you'd find in an aquatic ecosystem.
Right.
So
what's the adaptive benefit of this toxin? Why is it produced? Obviously, it's not being produced for humans. It's not being produced, you know, to ward off people. It's just I would assume it's likely just chance that this
defense mechanism.
Yeah, I mean,
from predation.
It is actually a defense mechanism.
Yes.
Oh shit.
So it's one of those defense mechanisms that's produced after a certain threshold of biomass is produced.
Wow. Okay. Because other stuff wants to eat this, and it's so what this bacteria is saying, don't eat me. It's saying, keep away, pal. Stay away from.
Yes. You know?
Don't get into. Don't be doing this stuff. I don't want this. You know. Let me do my thing. Leave me the fuck alone. That's basically what it's saying. Wow. Okay. So there must have been heavy selection pressure at some point in the evolutionary history of that particular microcystis bacteria to for this to evolve. What was eating it likely?
Oof. I mean, I'm not sure to be honest. I know, there's protozoans, some more arthropods and things like that. I know that it's very toxic to fish,
Shit.
But yeah.
So this stuff is just all around toxic, basically.
Oh yeah, and it's very toxic at very low concentrations too, which is, of course, like a public health like issue.
Wow. So it's like, if it comes to like, would you rather swim in a lake that has fecal coliform bacteria, or would you rather swim in a lake that has microcystis in it? You pick the fecal coliform lake, basically, right?
I just
say that because I'm from Chicago, and you know, I know what it's like on those hot summer days after a good rain when they got to dump all the shit into the lake, you know. And next thing you know, you're swimming around. There's turds floating by. Maybe there's a lot of bird shit too. But you get the fecal coliform warnings. And anyone who grew up in Chicago going to Lake Michigan in the summertime knows that those two words, fecal coliform. So luckily we don't get microcystis though, as far as I know. So yeah, anyway, you've been to Chicago before, right? You're from Minnesota.
Yeah, I've been in the winter. Oof.
yeah, it's brutal. People are assholes, but I like it. You know, it's kind of a rough town. It's not as, New York is nicer than Chicago. You know, I always tell people New York's rude, Chicago's full of assholes. But and any true Chicagoan will tell you that. If someone tries to tell you it's not full of assholes, they're not really, you know, they're from the suburbs or something. So yeah, we wear like a badge, like we're proud of our assholes. But anyway, okay, sorry for the digression. Okay, so let's talk about some of these other organisms in crusts, like algae, which people mostly assume are aquatic, but of course there's terrestrial ones too. What do they do? When do they show up in terms of succession? What's going on? And what's their association with fungi sometimes too?
Algae are interesting. They don't have quite the adaptability of the cyanobacteria, but they have an advantage in that they're able to grow in some places that are not really compatible with cyanobacterial physiology. For example, algae are much more likely to be the primary photosynthetic organism in a biocrust where the soil is very acidic. They also are generally found where conditions are more wet or the soil is more able to hold moisture, so siltier soils.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of associations with fungi, I think maybe people have heard of, you know, lichens. So these lichens can form a symbiosis with either a cyanobacteria or an algae. And those are organisms that the lichens will generally show up in much more ecologically developed biocrusts and in conditions that are much more moist and cooler as well.
Okay, so the cyanobacteria don't like it too moist. Some of them.
Right, yes, exactly. If it's too moist, they actually get outcompeted by other organisms that are much better able to grow in these more moderate and mild environments.
Right, okay. So the cyanobacteria are really adapted to that harsh lifestyle. So why do the algae do better in acidic soils than cyanobacteria?
It's, you know, I'm not exactly sure why. I think it's because they have you're bringing me back to my comps here. There's a certain mechanism that they have that cyanobacteria don't. Acidic conditions don't really mesh well with photosynthesis, but algae, or some algae at least, are better able to maintain an environment within their cells that allow them to stay in that environment.
Okay.
The specifics of it, I'm not sure, but...
Okay, no, that's plenty. That's good. So it's got to do with the structure and overall morphology. So, okay, man. So the algae show up, and those are probably spread by spores mostly, or how are they getting around?
Similar to how you would find the cyanobacteria being spread, obviously they're much larger, so they're not going to be carried as far on dust. So they mostly rely on overland spread through rain, movement of water.
Okay, and then of course, when they're enslaved by a fungus, or if you want to paint the rosier picture, when they're just farmed by a fungus, when you get the lichens showing up, I mean, lichens will, you'll find all these cool lichen species growing on the ground, forming crust too. I guess, I mean, so it's not just the cyanobacteria. The cyanobacteria kind of get everything prepped, and then once the lichens show up, how does that change the overall structure of this whole little ecosystem that's only, you know, a centimeter tall at most?
So yeah, the lichens, so around the same time, you'll get either lichens or mosses showing up in these biocrusts. And once they show up, you kind of see a decline of the cyanobacteria algae in general, because these lichens or mosses cover the surface of the soil and really block out the light for anything that is shorter than them. Mm-hmm. So you see that the cyanobacteria come in, do all the work of stabilizing, and then these other organisms come in, colonize, take advantage of this nice, stable, nutrient-rich environment, and kind of push the cyanobacteria out.
Right.
And depending on... Oh, sorry?
Oh, no, I was just saying... I was just... Go ahead, sorry.
And I was saying, and depending on how well the biocrust does after that, that's where you start getting the plants coming in, vegetation, the grasses, shrubs, things like that. And if conditions are right, you'll have an ecological succession right out of biocrusts into ecosystems that are more plant dominated.
Right, right. Fuck, it's, yeah, and I've seen that. I mean, you see that down here, you know, and in South Texas and a lot of parts of the Chihuahua Desert, you just, this extensive network. And then, you know, if it's been there a long time, you've got the small shrubs popping up, never any large trees, of course, generally not, but, you know, the whole ground is alive, but with the lichens, of course, now, you know, you've got, these lichens mostly are composed of fungal hyphae, which are made of chitin, correct?
Yes.
So what are these bacterial films made out of? These are just these exopolysaccharides?
Yeah. So they're just photosynthate. So complex chains of carbons, sugars that are actually difficult for other bacteria, other organisms to easily break down, and that's why they persist so long. That's why you can find a biocrust. You know, you can actually find biocrust in the fossil record, because once they're buried, they're very stable. And if they're continually producing, they're always able to keep up on their production of this slime. So
you've seen fossil, what are some of the oldest fossil biocrusts that are known?
I'm trying to think back of, so they found actually a biocrust, and they've actually found cytonamine. Traces of this cytonamine compound in these fossilized biocrusts, showing that cytonamine is very, very stable. Uh-huh. Hundreds of millions of years.
Jesus.
They've found them. And there's actually evidence to suggest that they were one of the first type of ecosystems that formed on lands, really.
Yeah. What would you do? I mean, how would you feel to go back to like the Devonian and study some of these communities back there? That would probably be pretty cool, would it not? I mean,
that'd be...
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, that'd be really cool. And probably it would be really interesting to see that they haven't changed very much. Either the function or the structure of them and how they function probably hasn't changed very much since way back then.
Right. I mean, now they're relegated to deserts primarily, but in arid environments or seasonally arid environments. But I mean, back then, but before land plants really evolved, they were probably everywhere. I mean, just
everywhere.
Extensive,
yeah.
Communities. Fuck, that's so cool to think about. So let's talk about like your personal work now, like some of the things that you really get passionate about, some of the places you've been that have just blown your mind. You know, that feeling like anyone who's in any, I kind of don't like this word, naturalist, anyone who's into biology or botany or fungi or whatever, that moment where you just, you're in the field and you're in a particular spot and you're like, this is so fucking cool and amazing. I don't know whether to like cry or laugh. Like, what are some moments like that for you that you've had where you've just been so just amazed and fascinated and also and just mixed with curiosity and passion? Like, where, what are some places that or memories that bring that home for you?
I think one of my biggest memories is when I took a trip to Moab, Utah. So that's near where Arches National Park is. I did some hiking there. You get that really beautiful red soil. Mm-hmm. And going on a long, not well-traveled hiking trail and coming around the corner and just seeing just biocrust as far as you can see, just very well-developed black, very rugose, so lots of bumps and craters, and it kind of felt like the surface of Mars, kind of. It was just, I'd never seen so much biocrust in one place, and it was just crazy that when you let it just be, that it forms just such these beautiful structures in the soil. And I love taking a little bit and looking at everything that's there under the microscope. It's crazy how well everything works together in these communities.
Yeah, it's no cows, no ATVs. I mean, just that's the thing that strikes me about it is when you look at the ground and you realize the fucking ground is alive. Like the whole ground, everything you're looking at is life. Like it's all metabolizing, it's all respiring, it's all photosynthesizing. It's fucking wild. It's such a cool feeling. How many species do you think, if you could do a species count of just the crust alone that was in your field of vision that time, how many species would you guesstimate you were looking at?
Oh man, I mean, it's hard to even comprehend from the mosses, the different type of mosses, to the lichens, down to the cyanobacteria, down to the communities of fungi, heterotrophic bacteria, archaea, everything that they support. Like, there's going to be millions of species there. These are just biodiversity hotspots in these very just intense edge of life environments. You just get these hotspots of life, like millions of species of these bacteria. Lichens, fungi, mosses, all of them.
Oh, it's so fucking cool, man. If there was one spot where you could go, well, a couple spots where you would love, like, say you could just pause time, you can get like a week there, you know, be paid for, whatever. Where would you go to look at these things? Like Atacama, inland Australia? Like, where would you think?
I think I really have been very, very interested in Arctic biocrusts. So either in the Arctic Circle or down in Antarctica, it's some of the only things that can live there is these biocrusts, these very cold-adapted biocrusts. And we don't know really anything about them. I think I would love to go there and see how they're formed differently than the ones found in these hot, dry places. If they function similarly, who's there, what they're doing. I think that would tell us a lot about the extremes of life on either end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we need to know if we're going to be looking for life other places.
So that's because that's wild to think of, too. I mean, people think of places like Antarctica as just covered in snow, but there's actually areas where it's not covered in snow. There's rock exposed, there's mountains, there's coastal areas that are only covered in snow half the time, right? I mean, where would you find crusts in Antarctica?
You'd have to find them where they obviously weren't buried in snow. So it would be along the coasts where you do get some exposure of the soil, the rocks, the surfaces to the sunlight during the parts of the year where they're able. That's where I would look for mm-hmm. sure.
Yeah. Yeah. What about inland Australia? Because that is like a parts of inland Australia can be extremely barren and rough. I mean, you think there's some pretty cool crust there or what?
Oh yeah, I think so. And it's actually, kind of a little bit of a mystery. The the molecular techniques and microbiology, microbial ecology of biocrusts is only just now catching up to the technology we have that has been used for, you know, the gut microbiome and all that. Nobody cares about that. We care about the environment. And more we're learning about how Australia is very interesting because the soils there are so old. That's really selecting for biocrust organisms that are much different than we find in other parts of the world.
And I think super it's fascinating. Tough. Yeah, totally. Because, yeah, there's not been much volcanic activity. Australia, a lot of the rocks, they're very, you know, billion years old or more. They've been totally leached. A lot of them are just granites that have been leached of any nutrients. So when you go out into the field, and we can wrap this up another 10 minutes or so, if you're cool with that. You go out into the field, how do you identify these things? Do you take a scope with you? Do you just collect some, bring it back to a lab? Obviously, PCR and DNA are extremely important. Initially, what do you do what morphological features are you looking at to figure out what the hell, you know, you're staring at?
Yeah, so it depends on kind of what you're looking at or what you're looking for. Obviously, as it gets more developed, the crust is easier to immediately recognize. You'll see that the soil is very bumpy. It might have that black pigmentation. A very good way to tell whether what you're looking at is just bare soil or actually if it has a biocrust living just below where you can see is you can either wet the soil and within 30 minutes or so you should see greening as the cyanobacteria come to the surface. Or if you take a little piece, maybe the size of a quarter or something like that, you should be able to hold it up horizontally and it should hold itself together and be able to be stable under its own crust, essentially. And you actually, if you pick up the piece, you may see what look to be little hairs dangling out the bottom with little soil particles attached. And those are actually the bundles of the cyanobacteria that are attached to the soil particles. I actually have a really cool picture I can send you that shows this. And it's a 100% guarantee that if you see those things, you have cyanobacteria, you have a crust there.
Yeah. Would you email me that photo after this conversation?
Yeah,
that would
absolutely
be cool. I'll use it as the thumbnail or something for this podcast. And again, those hairs, that's the exopolysaccharide chain or what are they exactly?
Those are the bundles. So those are, the cyanobacteria are within those ropes that are actually so big that you can see them with your eye. So they form those macro structures that you can see dangling like hairs out of the soil.
Jesus Christ. So one of those little hairs is composed of many filaments of bacteria, basically.
Yeah, thousands and thousands of filaments.
Jesus Christ. What do these things look like when you get them under a scope? I mean, are they, obviously they're not all, there's the filament structure, and then are there other, what other structures do these things take, you know, when you're looking at them under a scope and under what magnification?
So the filamentous cyanobacteria are about 5 microns in width, diameter. So you can see them very well under 400x with the 4D objective. You can actually pull a bundle out of the soil, put it under the microscope, and you can actually see inside of the bundle these filaments gliding past each other. They're always moving within these bundles.
Jesus Christ.
You can also look for these nitrogen-fixing cyanobacteria like Nostoc, Cytonema, and Telepothrix. You can pull them out. You can see the Nostoc kind of looks like a chain of beads, of green beads. With every so often, you'll see a cell that has no green, and those are the heterocysts. And you can see the Cytonema and Telepothrix under the scope. They look like these kind of yellowish brown filaments that create little branching patterns. They're false branching cyanobacteria. So they're very actually easy to distinguish under the microscope, and mm-hmm. that's kind of what we use a lot of times to identify them. Uh-huh. Before we use molecular methods.
Okay, before you, you know, look at the DNA, put primers in there and everything. So you're saying that some of these bacteria are actually, they're always moving. Under a scope, you see them moving.
Yes.
God damn, that's so. I mean, of course, I guess, duh, right? But to me, that's like I had no idea. You know, I need to get some of these soils I'm looking at, and you know, like the star cactus habitat, and just see what the fuck. It's such cool stuff. So when you do DNA sequencing, how do you go about that? Like step by step, you take a piece of soil or the film and put it in a PCR machine with, you know, primers in it, with specific bacterial primers, or what?
So there's a couple ways you can do it. So whether you want to get the whole community composition, or if you're looking just to see what cyanobacteria are there, you can either isolate the cyanobacteria. And what I usually do, the quick and dirty method, is once you have your isolate, you just put it in some water, microwave it to break the cells, and then you can use cyanobacteria-specific primers to amplify and do some Sanger sequencing, sequence the 16S, which is a gene marker for taxonomy used a lot in microbiology. Or you can do a whole community composition analysis. You take a piece of the crust, extract all of the DNA of everything in your sample, and then use general bacterial primers. So this will be primers that will amplify the DNA of all bacteria. Mm-hmm. You can also use ITS for fungi.
Okay.
And then you sequence all of that DNA, and you get a composition. You get composition data of what proportion of the community is what type of bacteria.
So when you get all the bacteria, primers that bond to all the bacteria, can you isolate different species from that to figure out what you're looking at then? Or how do you do that?
Yeah, yes, you absolutely can. So at least for bacteria, the taxonomy is pretty well resolved down to the genus level. You have some troubles with species level, but for the most part, the phylogenies of a lot of these organisms are pretty well defined. So you can generally differentiate between organisms at the genus level. Mm-hmm. for bacteria. So you can
good
you
enough
can
tell for me. That's good enough. Yeah.
Bacteria, things like that.
Yeah, that's good enough for me, man. That's like that's specific enough for me. God damn, man. Yeah, that's. That's really cool. So you got 16S. I know they use 18S for fungi and plants sometimes. 16S is that specific to bacteria primarily, or more helpful in bacterial DNA analysis, or what?
So yeah, so 16S is found in all organisms, especially, you know. So these 16S regions that we amplify are found specifically in bacteria and archaea.
Okay.
And it's the 16S is the part of the ribosome which creates proteins.
Okay.
So every organism that's alive can create proteins, so they will always have this gene.
Right. Super.
And that's why we target it.
Super conserved. Right.
Yes. Okay. Exactly.
We didn't even talk about archaea, but I promise I will let you go soon. Really quickly. How archaea are normally found in really extreme environments. How often do you find them in desert biocrusts?
So they are present there, but this is, again, another kind of hole. I feel like people are now realizing that archaea are actually an important part of communities, and now there's finally starting to be investigations of what archaea are in there and how can we resolve their taxonomic situation and what are they doing? So they're there, but we don't know what they're doing yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's probably a lot of undescribed species of all kinds of organisms still out there, right, that just haven't been described yet or investigated yet?
Yeah, exactly. We're always finding more.
With these crusts, yeah, man, it's fucking nuts. It's like, you know, detangling this web of life that we barely understand and that sadly is getting destroyed a lot. And on that note, say a area gets bulldozed, and then like the project falls through, they're going to put some ugly tract housing or like a, you know, more another soul destroying strip mall parking lot there. And it ends up not working. The investors bail or the economy collapses, thank God, or something like that. How long? And so the area gets bought by like a nature conservancy or something. How long does it take for this stuff to come back, for these soils to build up back to the diversity that they were at pre-destruction?
So that really depends on how much precipitation the area gets and how disturbed the community is. If you get fairly regular rainfall and it wasn't disturbed too much, you can get recovery in a couple of years. But if it's totally destroyed and it's a very dry area, it can take decades, sometimes even centuries if it's that dry. So it can really take a long time, and you lose all of those ecosystem services that are provided.
Right. You lose the nitrogen fixation, the carbon fixation, you know, putting organic material back in the soil, which then is just good for especially desert soils. You lose the what holds the soil together. These things obviously provide a benefit for water retention too, probably, right? They soak up water. And I mean, how do they affect water in deserts?
So they soak in the water, and they actually then form, once they're fully hydrated, they actually form a kind of like a cap on the soil, because once they're saturated, those exopolysaccharides suck up the water like a sponge, and you get this water layer on the surface of the soil that takes much longer to dry than just bare soil would, therefore allowing the underneath soil to stay wet longer.
And that thus benefiting any plants that are growing there too, probably, right?
Anything living has more time to be active.
Right, because that soil doesn't evaporate all its water so quickly. Man, these things are so fucking cool. So where would you, on that note, ending this, how would you recommend someone who's just getting into this, you know, didn't go to school for it, just, you know, someone who's just hiking all the time and sees these things and loves them and wants to learn more about them, books, would you recommend, say they got a couple hundred bucks, should they get a microscope if they're really into it, just start bringing stuff home to look at, or what do you recommend?
I would recommend just learning how to identify them. And one of the best ways to do that is to go outside after a rainfall event, whether even if you're not in an arid ecosystem, any area of the soil that the sun can touch, you'll generally find some sort of biocrust organism living there. And just being able to see where they live, what they look like when you're actually looking for it, you'll see them everywhere. And then from there, you can go wild. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting literature on the function of biocrusts. They're so interesting to look at under the microscope. I would definitely recommend that. And they're actually really easy and interesting to isolate. You can actually isolate these organisms and grow them at home.
How do you do that? That's crazy.
For example, you can go and, like you were saying, that you were like going and picking nostoc from the soil. You can find these nitrogen fixing cyanos right on the surface. You can pick them right up. You can actually pull the little bundles of the filamentous cyanobacteria from the soil as the little hairs and grow those in a. It would be kind of the same. You could grow them in water that has maybe a little bit of plant food, like a very, very dilute plant food to it that you can use to, you know, feed your house plants, and put them in a sunny window, and you'll get it growing in there.
Man, that's so cool. And you've obviously done this before. I mean, you've cultivated these things in a lab or what?
Yeah, I've done a ton of isolations with the different types. They all have their own unique morphologies and what they like and don't like, and it really says a lot about how many niches there are for these organisms.
Yeah, man. Yeah, every little piece to the puzzle. It's so cool. All right, well, Corey, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate the hell out of you. And where can people learn about your work? You got a Twitter account, I guess, papers online. Tell us more.
So if you're interested in any of my work, I actually have a Google Scholar profile. So you can go right on Google Scholar, look for my name, Corey Nelson, Corey Nelson. You'll see a lot of my microbial ecology work of biocrusts. Actually, I've done some ecological restoration work as well, trying to grow biocrusts. You can learn a lot about what I do there, and also attached to that profile is my Twitter and my ResearchGate page, where you can kind of see what I'm doing now and kind of catch up with what I'm doing.
Okay, great. Yeah, that's how I found you, was your Twitter, man. So this has all been fucking great. I'm so thankful to you. And yeah, man, I really appreciate your time. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, no problem. Have a great day.
Okay, you too.